to put it in a rather simple way, oversimplistic, it is possible that you and I have got a bad habit. Must we therefore avoid talking about it?
No.
So, we go on talking about it, and it is possible that one of these days we might also give these things up. If we don't give these things up, they give us up. So why not?
What I find the difficulty is that the verbal world, which I see others demonstrating in myself all the time, of thinking that what you're saying coincides with your own behavior, and it far from does. The verbal world seems so removed.
And therefore,
why don't you stop talking about it?
Then you have lost both. You are not doing what you should do, let's put it that way, simply. And you are at least talking about what you should do. If you stop talking about what you should do, you have lost that also. If you stop talking about that, would that produce action? Right action? It doesn't seem to. So if you go on talking about it, it's possible one of these days it'll get somewhere.
An optimist.
Yes, sure. Yes, sir, but even if I am sincere, some of these things cannot be helped. I'll tell you one thing that shocked me and the other thing that I could see. I've told the story to some of my other friends, older friends here. Swami Shivananda did not belong to the order of naked Swamis. And there is an order of naked Swamis in India. And there is a very great man in South India who passed away only in early 50s or late 40s. And very great man, enlightened man. He had two or three disciples. And one of them happened to be a retired civil servant who became this man's disciple only after retirement, which was about 55, 56. And he probably was a lay disciple till then. And when he retired, he wanted to renounce the world and join that order. And that order meant not a stitch of cloth on you. He was prepared to do that. But for 50 years, he had been using snuff. And that could not be given up like clothes. Clothes can be discarded, but some other things cannot be discarded. It's not so easy. We can talk fantastic philosophy, but this talking doesn't drop the snuff. So it is a funny sight. And this man, I have the greatest reverence for him. He was a very, very great man. Very great man. We used to call him Tata Swami, his old man. Delightful man. The picture of humility, the picture of simplicity, the picture of forbearance, everything. All the saintly qualities you think of, he had. But the snuff he could not abandon. So there was this man walking about naked, stark naked with a snuff box in one of his palms. Pardon?
In your pocket.
There's no pocket. So yet he was carrying the snuff box in his hand. Delightful man, very, very holy. Exceptionally holy man. Someone has, I got a book here, I'll show you if you don't believe me. He was a great political leader and that sort of thing. And I was also a religious man in Bombay. He has translated Jnaneshwar's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. Jnaneshwar Maharaj, very tremendously inspiring text. And in the introduction, he says, I don't understand what I'm doing. But I am conveying this knowledge to the English-speaking public. The original was in Marathi. And please don't look to my own qualification for doing this. And he says, if you are walking through a dense bush, and you see someone carrying a lantern a few paces ahead, would you use the light to walk that path across the bush? Or would you begin to inquire into whether you are a thief or a prostitute or this, that and so on? Christian, Hindu. So in a way, that anxiety also must be dropped. And if you drop that anxiety, that I must be the perfect exemplar of all that I teach. If you drop that anxiety, then you drop the teaching. Definitely you drop teaching. And then you realize what it is to share. We are both in the same boat. One of the white cloth man with thick glasses who used to give talks on the Bhagavatam there, he used to quote me quite often. Once I said in the satsang in Rishikesh, if there are 100 people in the hall there, it is possible that 85 don't understand what I'm saying. Of the 15, it's possible 14 are fast asleep. Some have scatterbrains, they're thinking of something else, and so many things, nobody is interested in what I'm saying. But there is one person who can't help listening to every word, every sound, every little pause, and that's myself. I have one guaranteed audience. All the rest are doubtful. So when you consider yourself part of the audience, there is no shyness at all. There is no hesitation. You know, I'm not doing this. What will he think if I... if I say what I am not really practicing. If you want to teach, that's a different story. If you are the guru and we are your disciples, then you run into a very serious problem. And even there, for instance, I'll give you one story of Swami Shivananda. I think there's one picture there with a heavy overcoat.
Yes.
That one, right. He was wearing that coat and giving a talk during a reception accorded to somebody from Ceylon. It was done in Swamiji's own veranda. I can still picture holding a finger like this. Kaupinamanta khalu bhagyavantaha. Meaning, Only they are blessed who are able to walk about clad merely in loincloth. Yes? Swami Sivananda was wearing possibly 4 or 5 layers of clothing, underclothing, and on top of it a heavy, big, thick nylon coat. Yes, but the truth is not altered. Kaupi namanta khalu bhagyavanta. That was the theme of the whole day's whole discourse that night. If you say that unless you walk about naked, we won't what? Even listen to you. Right. He does that now. He says, all right, you people object to my not being an exemplar of what I am teaching. Now hereafter I am going to be an exemplar of what I am teaching. So he drops all his clothes and he walks about only in loincloth. He is used to it. We are not. That's what you are going to say. You will still not follow. There is a very interesting expression in the Bhagavad Gita. Mama vartma anuvartante manushya partha sarvashah. I must set an example because people will follow my example. If the teaching had ended there, it would have been possibly inspiring, or I don't know what. But it is followed by Yedihyaham Navarteyam Jatu Karmanya Tendrataha Mama Vartmanu Vartante Manushya Partha Sarvacha. Meaning, if I do not do what I should do, people will follow my example. The first verse was, Yadyat acharatis sreshtaha tattadeva itaro janaha. Whatever the superior man does, the others will do. The next verse says, if I fail in my duty, everybody will follow my example. It doesn't say that if I do my duty, everybody will similarly do his duty. Oh no. Sorry. You do not follow somebody's good example. If you are capable of doing that, there are plenty of people who set excellent example. If you observe the mind merely says, aha, he is my guru, he smokes 3 cigarettes a day. But he smokes, doesn't he? So 3 packets is all right. There's a funny story told of Shankaracharya. I don't think this is in the official biography. Yeah. Legend. It seems one day he and 3 or 4 of his disciples were walking through a desert country. It was very hot, dry, and it was around midday. They were all dying of thirst. There was no village, no house, nothing in the whole area. They saw a thatched hut on the roadside. They entered. It so happened that it was a tavern where they sell some sort of a brew called toddy. It's made of palm juice, something, coconut palm, sap from the coconut palm, fermented, strong. Shankaracharya went in along with his disciples. He looked on, he asked them, do you have water? He said, we don't drink water. You have plenty of this? What do you want water? As someone said, I believe, in a restaurant in Paris, when a vegetarian teetotaler asked for water, they brought in a bowl, finger bowl. And he said, no, I want a glass of water. Glass of water, what for? He said, to drink. And the waiter laughed and gave him a glass of water and said, if you, a human being, drinks water, what will a cow drink? So they didn't drink water. They had only this toddy, plenty of. Shankaracharya thought, all right, we are thirsty. He poured himself a drink. And the disciples thought, oh, that's nice. That's nice. And they also poured themselves a couple of drinks. Shankaracharya saw this and he couldn't correct them because he was doing it, and so there is no sense in correcting, telling them not to do. He walked on. But this time deliberately he avoided all habitation. Kept on wandering in the desert till they were madly thirsty again. And this time he walked into the blacksmith's workshop. And he didn't even ask for water, nothing. He went straight to where the blacksmith was cooking molten lead. He didn't even ask for permission, went there, took a glassful of molten lead and drank it. And these disciples saw, oh, oh. And he turned to them and said, aren't you thirsty too? And they said, no, we are not. So, if you set an example, is anybody going to follow that example? No. So, the teaching is not to set an example. The teaching is a teaching. And the teaching has its own validity, totally regardless of whether or not you are an exemplar of the teaching. One needn't be a hypocrite, right? If I teach you, I'll be a hypocrite. If I teach you and I'm not following the teaching, I'm a hypocrite. I'm sharing with you, I'm serving you. As a matter of fact, on the other extreme, am I right in saying that barmaids are not allowed to be drunk while serving? So, you must get others drunk. But you should be very sober. Sharing of the truth has no concern whatsoever, has no objection whatsoever, in whatever condition. And if, for instance, you are a victim of the evil that you condemn in, not in others pointedly, but this is evil. It's quite possible that one of these days something in you will also hear it. This is another story that most of them know. Anyhow, stories can be listened again and again. There was a notorious robber, and one day he decided to rob the king of that place. So at midnight, he entered the palace and sort of walked along the passage towards the king's bedroom, knowing that the keys to the treasure were in the bedroom. So he inched quietly. When he was fairly close to the bedroom, there was noise in the bedroom. past midnight. And so he stopped dead. The king and the queen are awake. No mischief can be done now. And the queen was telling the king the content of her dream or a vision. She said, "Lord, you know, I had a fantastic vision in which the angel of God appeared to me and said the following. My dear, I realize that you are worried about your daughter's wedding. How to find a bridegroom? Who is the bride? They are an only daughter. I'll tell you. Listen very carefully. Get up as soon as you can. Wake up your husband as soon as you can. And let him go in a certain direction outside the village or town, in a certain direction. And you will find a magnificent young man seated under a peepal tree. Don't bother about his appearance and qualifications and so on. He is the man destined to be your son-in-law. And don't take no for an answer. This is what God Almighty asks me to convey to you." And the queen was narrating all this to the husband. And the thief was listening from outside. And you know what he did. He ran, intending to murder if there was somebody sitting there and take his place. But to his surprise, there was nobody there. So he sat there in deep meditation and samadhi. 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning. There was rustling of the leaves on the ground. He knew that somebody was coming. So he closed his eyes even firmer. A yogi in samadhi is not disturbed by rustling leaves. And then after 5 minutes or so, he felt cool flowers being placed around his neck. But then he didn't open his eyes, because he's yogi, huh? Then eventually, curiosity got the better of him. Gently opened his eyes and saw this man standing, sitting in front of him. "Ah, who are you? Look like a king." He said, "Yo, yo." "He knows that. He knows that I am a king." He said, "Really a great yogi. And this is what the man chosen by God to be my son-in-law." And he said, "Yes, my lord, please accept my salutations. Please, will you come to the palace?" "No, no, 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 no. Palace I won't come. I'm a mendicant. I'm a yogi. I'm a man of renunciation. I won't enter palaces." "Oh," he started crying, weeping, and, "please, please, please, you must come. I see it is the divine will." Good. So he went. Then the king himself led him right to the throne and put him there. "It's terrible, terrible, terrible. I'm not used to this. I'm used to bed of thorns and that sort of thing." Once again the king cried, and "all right, he says, God's will, I'll sit there." Then came the queen. "Don't you look. Men of renunciation don't look at women." Then they brought the young girl, the princess, and they worshipped and all that. Every time he protested first and detested and all that. And then they cried and wept, persuaded him. Then he looked at his eyebrow and said, "This is God's will." And eventually, like a bolt from the blue, the king made the proposal. "Here is my daughter, and you must accept her." "Ayoyo," he said. "Terrible." Then again, once again, the whole drama was repeated. God's will. And when he finally said, "God's will, all right, I'll accept to marry her," the king was thrilled and the queen was thrilled. They took him to a great, fantastic room in the palace, gave him all the royal robes, sent a couple of barbers and things like that. And there he was, dressed up, decked up, like a prince. So everybody had gone away. And the wedding was to take place in half an hour's time. And he stood there in front of the mirror and looked at him, aye, aye, aye. He said, you are a clever man. And lucky too. Huh? He kept looking into the mirror. Something entered into him. God knows what. He said, good grief. If for pretending to be a yogi for 1 hour, a thief could inherit a kingdom, I am about to inherit the whole kingdom. What would I not get if I really renounced the world and became a real yogi? The very thought shook him from head to foot. So he tore off all these things and threw them out and jumped out of the window, ran to become a real yogi. Possible. This is a story. This is a story. Because even a hypocrite has a chance somewhere or the other. Of course, if he had become king, he would have been doomed forever. That's my advice, where advice is sought, is that where there is a sort of confusion, don't do anything. I read that on an advertisement near Port Louis. Do not start a thing which you cannot stop. Have you seen that? Just near the Sunray Hotel. It's probably some kind of brake lining or brake fluid or something like that. Huh? It's got something to do with the brake mechanism in a motor car. Don't start a thing which you cannot stop. So as long as it can be stopped, go ahead. If you reach a point of no return, then of course it's risky. If you marry and have a baby and then you start talking about renunciation, it's absurd. Probably you won't. The mind will undergo a definite change and spin its own philosophy of how, what a marvelous thing it is to raise a future Buddha. Then the mind says, no, it's not that. I could have become a Buddha myself, but after all, I took to this path only when I was 25, 30 and so on. And if I give birth to a Buddha, now he could be trained right from... That's your job. You choose... I'm not even quite certain that...
So what is renunciation? Is it sort of when you don't pick things up anymore?
When you don't pick things anymore, you don't pick. What is renunciation?
Is it when sort of you don't want to do things you were doing before? Is it sort of when...
Do you renounce them or do they renounce you? What you can only renounce what you have, which can be renounced.
Well,
what is it you have which can be renounced? Thank you very much. Are you quite sure? What about the mala around your neck or your tracksuit?
I don't want to
renounce
it.
That's That means you have them. Yes. Renouncing them is renunciation. All right. But that is not true. They are not your drag suit. They were hanging in some shop window a few months ago.
Yeah, but
what is it that really belongs to you? The answer to that question is renunciation. If it is so, it's all right. But you may throw away worn-out clothes. That's not renunciation.
No, no. I'm just saying that if the inner process is of the essence of this, not necessarily taking the clothes off or being.
Not necessarily yes, but it may mean both. That's it. It cannot be defined.
You know that.
Again, you are worried about doing about it. Examine yourself and see in regard to what you have the feeling, this is mine. Can you give that up?
I don't think I can.
Then there is no renunciation, that's all. No, no. It's nothing. It takes mere understanding, that's all. In regard to what do you have the feeling that this is mine? And now, if you, on the basis of this simple inquiry, if you look at the sannyas, ideal and all that sort of thing, you realize why they reduced what they called, what you called their possessions to the minimum, so that there's not too much of a burden.
But it even comes down to your own thoughts.
Correct. Precisely. Right. Precisely.
And if you renounce that, well then it just goes...
No. You don't have to renounce that. Do you regard them as your thoughts?
Well, most of the time I do, yeah. Most of the time I do, yeah.
Is that so? Are those thoughts yours?
I don't know. I mean, they pass through, don't they?
No, the question is, are they yours?
Occasionally.
Are they yours, really?
No.
Even occasionally? No, don't just say yes or no. The question is, the answer is not yes or no. The answer is a process. No. The answer is a process. And that whole process is a renunciation.
Yeah, but if I can see the answer, I'll know what renunciation is. If I can't see, I don't know what it is.
No. Even if you see the answer, it is not a static answer. It is not a single answer, which is like yes or no. All thoughts are mine, or no thoughts are mine.
Yeah.
Some thoughts are mine, some other thoughts are not mine. These are all very definite statements which have nothing whatsoever to do with the truth. The observation is a process, and the answer is a process.
Yeah.
And the process of inquiring into the nature of this sense of possession is renunciation. Already, that's enough. And now you can see also why there is not such an obsessive consideration of, am I practicing this or not? you are observing this and you see that you call somebody my wife. And the observation tells you she's only called my wife, but in reality she's not. And now, can I kick her out? Can you kick her out and walk out? That is another attachment. That's another angle. Now, in as you very rightly said, you are clinging to a thought that I must renounce this woman and must not be her husband anymore. She must not be my wife anymore. And so you run away from her, clinging to your thought. A thought called renunciation. And if you look at that, hey, what am I doing now? That was mine. The thought that I must renounce this person is mine. And so I have not renounced that. If you renounce that also, what happens to you? It's impossible to answer that question. It's an ongoing process, endless process, beginningless process. And as Priscilla said, it's possible that the inner spirit of renunciation overflows as orange dress. There's no objection to it.
But it must go somewhere. Like, I mean, why people do renounce is because they're aware that...
I'm not certain that they renounce. That's what I'm questioning. I'm not quite certain that they renounce. Renunciation is not an event which is confined to a historical date, so that you can say that I renounce the world on so and so. It is an ongoing process, endless process.
Wouldn't it have an end? Like, wouldn't one time it end? I mean, like, in the sense that you're...
3 minutes before that, you would not be able to talk to me. If you are going to reach that end, 3 minutes before that, you would not be able to talk to me. And I wouldn't know where you are.
Wow.
That's it. End. If everything is ended, how would I know you, who you are, and how would you know where I am?
No, but, well,
the very idea that you are talking to me shows that you have not renounced me. The very idea that you are talking shows that you have not renounced the idea that you are the body. Renunciation leads you right up there.
Right up there on your way down here?
Sure. Sure. You get up and sit down and keep looking at it. Please don't laugh. That is precisely what we are doing, sir. When we are talking about renunciation, that is precisely what we are doing. We have an enormous mirror on top and we are looking at it. That is the ideal of renunciation. We are down below, we are looking at it and contemplating it. And there is absolutely no harm in it, as long as it doesn't lead to total stagnation, which in effect is assuming you are there. And therefore, while we are talking about renunciation, I am not saying that I am a paragon of renunciation and I am telling you. I am also a member of the audience. You are also a member of the audience.
Yeah.
And you are sharing the inquiry concerning renunciation with everybody else.
Om Asatoma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Shanti.